If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, I'm Naomi. I'm 36. I was on the fence about pregnancy and all I heard was, don't you have any maternal instinct? And, but kids will bring so much joy to your life. But now I'm pregnant, it's, your bladder control will never be the same again, you know. Yeah, I do know. Thanks. It's already screwed. But despite deciding to baby, there's still so much more to find out from both camps. So here's a podcast on the Secret Recordings Network where I chat to baby wanters, baby rejecters, and everything in between to see why we decide to baby or not to baby. In this episode, I chat to Karina about the emotional rollercoaster of a journey she had to intended parenthood after cancer.
She was born 5 years after she was created as an embryo, and her parents had been through so much, and this woman who was once a stranger nurtured her, grew her, gave her life, and then she was in my arms as if that was where she belonged.
And I'm joined on this journey by my sister and best friend, Camilla.
Is this where you play the montage? Of my hellos. Do you know, I'm really annoyed with myself because after last week I was thinking I was going to look up like a really cool way that I could say hello and I didn't, so sorry to disappoint.
Maybe next week you can come at us with a new language of hello.
I will do that.
So at this point I am 20, I'm losing track of how many weeks now. 27 weeks.
Yeah.
God. Am I 27 weeks?
You wait till it's 30, then you'll be like, oh, to the M to the G.
I think that's why I'm freaking out a bit about 27, because God, that feels really close to 30. Jeez Louise. So I'm 27 weeks pregnant. And I feel like we took a big step in the now we're starting to feel like this is really happening because we bought a pushchair. And the main reason I'm so excited about, well, actually, there are two reasons why I'm really excited about buying a pushchair. Anyone who has ever considered buying a pushchair will understand the utter minefield of trying to find the right pushchair. Did you have this when you were getting one for Chester?
See, it is absolutely ridiculous. But these are the kind of things that I leave to Ed, because he just loves going on the internet and trawling all the reviews and like looking at all the YouTube videos and deciding which one is going to be the best. So I just trust him and go, you go for it.
Oh, see, me and Dan both have, I reckon in total, I have spent 20 hours online reading reviews of pushchairs because we've not been able to go anywhere and have a go.
Life is too short for that. Just go with the recommendation. Stop worrying about it. Go for it.
Yeah, but this is the problem, because you go, oh, well, I want a really lightweight, compact one because I live in a city and I'm going to need it to be on narrow pavements where there's millions of cars parked on the side of the road, and I'll be walking the dog in the park, but that's on a pavement, so that's what I want. But then you go, oh, well, they're not really good for newborns because the baby gets rattled around loads and they're not very protective for them and blah, blah, blah. And you need this one. And then I'm like, but that won't fit in the boot of my car. Oh, God, it's just, anyway.
Well, there was 5 minutes in your brain.
So that's one reason why I'm excited that we've got a pushchair. Because
one reason.
Thank God, I don't have to worry about any of that stuff anymore. It's done. The decision is made. It's done.
And like I said to you, people are always selling things online, because sometimes people get something, they decide it's not really for them, so they get another one. It's okay. There's loads of people everywhere that having babies or transferring from a small pushchair to a big pushchair all the time. So it's not, you don't worry about it.
Okay, well, you'll be pleased to know I'm not worrying about it anymore because we've got one.
Good.
And the better news still is that I managed to get, so I would say I am like queen of the X display purchase. I am queen of the, you know, when you go to IKEA and you get to the end bit and it's the bargain bin of either X display stuff or maybe something where the packaging was damaged and it's like half the price that it's meant to be. Only bloody well and did it with a pushchair, didn't I? So,
but I did it with the car seats. Do you think this is something that's been passed on to me and you?
Oh my God, maybe. Well, I mean, what's even better is you're giving me the car seat. So I get a double bargain bin bargain. But the pushchair that we bought, retail price is like 770 quid. We got it for 460 because the hood was missing. Boom! It wasn't even X display, so it's not even been manhandled by lots of coronavirus hands. Yes.
Well done. Pat on the back for that one.
You were mid-30s, in your 30s, and unexpectedly found out that there might be fertility problems for you. Do you want to kind of explain what happened?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I was 33 years old at the time. Hadn't obviously considered the effects of cancer on anyone, really. It wasn't something I was familiar with, nothing, I didn't know anything about it. And we went to an oncology appointment just before I was due to start chemotherapy. And my oncologist sat me down and he said, oh, you know, all of the usual, this is the disease within you. And that's what we were worried about. And then sort of just from the left field, he goes, and you need to consider your fertility. And he said, oh, your fertility might suffer, your mid-30s nearly. You know, if you were to try and have a baby 5 years after you've started treatment, you'd be nearly 40. And there's a chance that your ovaries just wouldn't have recovered from chemotherapy. You'd go straight into early menopause. And we had some conversations and he told me about a medication I could take, which was essentially an implant that goes into your abdomen and it puts your ovaries to sleep. So what actually happens during chemotherapy that damages your ovaries is that chemotherapy targets cells that rapidly divide in the body, because a cancer cell divides faster than a healthy cell. There are other cells in our body that do that, which are our hair, our nails, and our ovaries. I didn't know that, but because the ovaries divide faster than other cells in the body, the chemo would target them and as a result they'd get damaged. So he said to me, you know, you have two options. I can put your ovaries to sleep, which means the cells won't be dividing rapidly, so the chemo shouldn't target them. And I was like, or I could have IVF. I'd read on the forums that some people had done it. So I was like, throw it in there, see what he says to me right now. And he was like, you could, but I wouldn't recommend the IVF. You've got a very estrogen sensitive tumor. So they grade and mark and check your tumour. Mine was 8 out of 8 on oestrogen and progesterone. So a very hormonally sensitive cancer within me. So he said, you know, there are risks. If you were then to go and now have IVF, you're going to be putting hormones into your body. We know that the cancer's feeding off hormones. It's your call. By this time, I had had a mastectomy. So I'd said, well, I had the mastectomy last month. You know, and he goes, yeah, you did. And that reduces your risk because, you know, we've taken the main cancer out of your body. And now the purpose of chemo is to target the rogue cells. So we sort of had a long chat about it, you know, about how passionately or how driven we were to have a family versus how much we needed to start chemotherapy. And his view was, and he said it and the words stick in my head, I'm here to save your life, not to create a new life. And it really made me think, geez, like, this is really serious. You know, what do we do here? And for us as a couple, it was, you know, we don't want to come through cancer and then find we can't have our own biological children. So we asked for the IVF and he said, okay, fine. It's, you know, it was the 9th of October or something like that. He's like, you have to start chemo by the end of the month. I'm not giving you a day longer than the 31st of October. So I was like, okay, fine, let's try this. So I was really lucky. Well, I'm not sure lucky is right, but, you know, put it into perspective, I was lucky on that day that the very next day after my consultation, I was due my period anyway. So he basically, my oncologist was like, you're going to have to move so quickly on this. I have one consultant on my books who potentially will see you up at Barts Hospital. I'll give her a ring. He went away, made the call. He goes, right, you're seeing her tomorrow at 10 a.m.
Wow.
I was like, okay, fine, we're doing this. So we were like, okay, let's do this. I was really lucky that my period came in at the same day. So we went up there. she goes to me, when's your cycle due to start? Because we need to work with your cycle. And I said, oh, well, do you know what? I've just come on my period like 30 minutes ago. And she was like, perfect, we're starting treatment. I remember sitting there and the doctor was writing all these notes and I was just like, I don't understand a word of what's written on that paper. Like, she's talking about follicles and she's talking about stimulation and she's talking about all these injections. And like, the nurse took us into a room and this all happened in the space of like 6 hours. And this nurse took us into a room and she was like, right, day one, you're going to put this in and then you're going to do this and you're going to do this. And I was literally like, I've just had my boob cut off. Like, I'm not ready to deal with this. But we just didn't have a choice, you know. I could just hear my oncologist in the back of my head, like, 31st of October, you're not having any longer. And I was like, and rightly so, because actually I want to live through cancer. Yeah. Like, so I have to have that conscious awareness that I am here to actually be treated for cancer primarily. And fertility preservation is secondary to that.
So you basically, you had your original operation for your cancer, then you went through the IVF procedure, which was to freeze embryos, not just your eggs, right?
Yeah, we were asked the question, do you want to do eggs or embryos? And I'm not going to lie, at a point in time, I did think, should I do eggs? Because is my husband going to probably leave me because I've got cancer?
Did you actually think, like...
Honestly, we were like 33, we were young, you know, vibrant people. And I just thought, why would this guy want to stay? I've now lost a boob. I'm about to lose my hair. I'm about to lose my fertility. What is left of the woman he married? And I wonder if people who are infertile have a similar mental struggle that, you know, you feel you're letting your spouse down. If the problem lays with you. And I even spoke to the clinic and I said, shall I do half and half or what should we do? And they were like, you have to make your mind up and, you know, you have to decide what's right for you. And in the end, we decided on embryos. You know, obviously I spoke to...
What did you say to your husband? I mean, so if you're going through all this, did you say that to him?
Yeah, I did. sounds awful, but I think that's life with cancer, to be honest. As soon as I was diagnosed, I thought that. And I said it to him a few times, like, if you want to go, I won't hold it against you. Like, if you can't deal with this, it's fine. And my oncologist used to always write in my medical notes as well. When I'd had reviews, he'd be like, oh, Queena attended clinic today with her really supportive husband. And I asked him, like, a few years later, I was like, why did you always put that in my letters? And he was like, the amount of relationships I see that fail because of a cancer diagnosis is unreal. So if a husband is supportive and he's literally there for every appointment that, you know, my husband would sit with me in chemo. He was there through my surgeries, everything. And he goes, you know, he needs to be acknowledged for the support he's giving. And I think after I'd had various chats with people about eggs or embryos, I thought, do you know what? He's a good egg. Like, he's going to stick around. So we'll go with embryos. And we made that call that it would be embryos we froze. But the weirdest thing was when you do all of this, the paperwork and the form filling and the consents, there was a section that made us think about what happened to the embryos if one of us passed away. And that was a really poignant point for us because I remember saying to him, if I die, I would still want you to find a way to bring these embryos to life because it would be a part of me. It's a weird way to think of it, but it was almost my legacy I was creating. So it wasn't just an embryo or just a baby. It was, if my life doesn't continue after cancer, I've still done something to leave my family a piece of me.
What a mental... I can't think of a polite way of saying head fuck, so I'm just going to have to say head fuck. Like, that situation is that you're going through this thing of wanting to make a life, but you're not knowing if you're going to...
Yeah.
Stick around for it.
Yeah, and it was really difficult. It was so hard. The question has been with me throughout my life after cancer as well on why did we do IVF at that point in time? And it was so at that, you know, before I started chemotherapy, it was almost like I kept asking myself, why am I doing this? Am I going to be alive to see these potential children? I remember the day that you get a call from the clinic, you know, after you've had all your procedures and everything, and they call you to tell you how many eggs were fertilized. And with oncology patients, they freeze on day one. So I got a call the day after my harvesting, and a lady calls up from the embryology team and she goes, oh, I'm so happy, you know, we collected 13 embryos, 12 we managed to get fertilized, one was damaged on freeze, so we've got 11 in the freezer for you. And I remember just wanting to hang up really quickly. And her, she was so bouncy and like, oh my God, I'm so happy for you. And I was like, I'm not even connected to those embryos right now because I've gone into this depressive state of chemo's here. You know, this is my reality. And actually, I might have just been an idiot for doing that because have I made my health worse? And have I done it for no reason? Because I'm going to die anyway.
Just walked past two mums in the park with two cute little babies and buggies, and both of the mums were doing really good, top quality baby talk. Oh yeah, did it to the babies. And I feel I'm rubbish at baby talk because I feel like a bit of an idiot. Is this a skill that I will develop potentially as a mum? Like, will that just happen naturally? Or will I just have to fake it till I make it? So you had your chemo.
I did.
And that went well.
Yeah, as well as well can be, I guess, yeah.
And but then there was another spanner thrown into the works.
There was, right. So we finished chemotherapy. That was sort of in 2014. I went through 2015, had my second boob removed, risk reduction, got through that, and then was going on a little jolly holiday to celebrate the end of everything related to breast cancer. Yeah, it was happy times. And it was the summer of 2016. And within 24 hours of landing, I was like really coughy, chesty. And I was like, oh, I'm one of those people who always gets a cold after a long haul flight.
Same.
It's so annoying. That night, didn't sleep at all. If I laid down, I was literally breathless to the point where I was probably going to turn blue. So had to be seated up, upright, had to cough to get air into my lungs. And I was like, I really need medical help now. This is going a bit too far. I was getting dizzy. So we went to this hospital, which was sort of the closest one we could get to, really. And they tested and tested and tested and couldn't find anything wrong with me. At that point, I literally was losing consciousness. There are massive blackouts in that evening that I don't remember what happened. And this guy comes up to me, and I will never forget this. He held my hand and he goes, I'm not going to ask you to say a word, but just either nod your head or squeeze my hand if the chemotherapy you had was red in colour. And it was, because we used to jest when I was on chemo that it literally looked so toxically poisonous. They used to cover the bag so you wouldn't have to see the red massive dye that was being pumped into you. So I squeezed it. I instantly knew that my chemo was red. And they were like, your chemotherapy has damaged your heart. You have now got heart failure. It's a really difficult time for you. I can't tell you you're going to survive this. And I recorded my goodbyes to people I love just in case I was to go there and then. I had to sort of make peace with where I was and that this was it. So we came out of the sort of the critical care period, and then I got moved out of ICU onto a ward. And I think that was sort of a real mark. I was like, right, I'm coming out of ICU. This is like definitely a good thing. Anyway, as we got to the back end and I was sort of feeling better in myself before I got moved up to a ward, I one day got this message on Facebook Messenger from a lady. So surrogacy had been on my radar for ages. And she was like, oh, hi, my name's Ina. I've seen you on the forums and, you know, I just think your story is incredible. And I've never been a surrogate before. I'm looking into it. And I just wondered if you wanted to chat and get to know me. And I was like, fucking dying in Vancouver. But you know, never give up hope. So I was like, yeah, sure. And then I told her that I'd had heart failure and I was in ICU and I didn't really know what the future held, but I'm called to chat if she wanted to chat. Like, and she was like, yeah, we should just talk. And I
feel like you picked the worst times to think about, like, let's think about this fertility stuff, like literally in the eye of the storm.
It's mental, but she did it. She came into my inbox. And what, you know, now I look at it, I'm like, even when people in the hospital were giving up hope, you know, like on whether I would have a decent quality of life afterwards, this woman who I've never met didn't judge me or didn't care what was going on in my, she was like, I'm just going to get to know you. Mm. I'm not sure I ever would have had that level of hope without her. I would have always thought, oh, I want to get through this. I need to get through this. But subconsciously, she must have pulled me through in ways that no one else could.
So when you're chatting to her at that point, how much are you chatting to her thinking maybe this is going to happen?
I think I really did think it, I felt connected to her. I very much believe in sort of spirituality and divine timing. And I couldn't help but think, for this sort of thing to happen in this circumstance, like, it's not a coincidence. And she continued to stay with me through this journey. And I think I just thought, if anyone's going to do it, it's her. And so, you know, there was a real drive to come back, to get better and to get onto this journey of becoming a mum. So we, Ina and I carried on chatting, and we were like, oh, we should meet up soon. And then I was on a girly holiday with my two best friends. We just did a, we do a cottage break, but we basically went to Downton Abbey, right? We love Downton Abbey. So we decided that this trip we were going to go and sit to Highclere Castle. So we'd booked a cottage there and we'd done that. And then we had a free day, and one of my friends goes, oh, let's go to the Christmas markets at Bath. Let's just drive up. And I was like, okay, yeah, cool. Let's do that. Anyway, I didn't put two and two together that Ina lives near Bath, but we were chatting, and then I messaged her and I was like, I'm going to Bath and something tells me you live near Bath. I'm going to the Christmas markets. I don't suppose by any chance you're in the area. And then she was like, oh my God, I'm going to the Bath Christmas markets today with my son. Like, let's meet up. So we hadn't planned to meet that day, but we both happened to be in the same city doing the same thing. And she was like, I'll meet you by the tourist office. And I was like, okay, fine. And then I didn't tell my friends what I was doing because I was too scared to let anyone. I was almost too scared to believe this could be happening to me. And I basically said to them, oh, I've just got to go and do something and meet this friend of mine. They were like, oh, okay, fine. Yeah, go on, you carry on. We're not stupid. We know you're looking at surrogacy, yeah. You know, whatever. We went for a coffee and we just spoke and we got on. You know, she just said a few things that really resonated with me. And she said to me, oh, whenever I match with someone, I don't want them to put me on a pedestal. I'm just doing what I want to do. And I don't want anyone to feel indebted to me. And I thought it was so humbling to hear that. Like, she was just so humble. I feel as IPs, you don't give yourself credit. An intended parent is someone who's looking to have a baby through surrogacy. And I feel like we put ourselves down. And if I'm honest, when I first joined the forums, I felt like that. I felt like I'm in competition with everyone else who wants to have a baby in this way. I felt like, what have I got that someone else hasn't got? Why would someone choose me? But actually, when I sat with Ina, she almost made me feel like, you're more than good enough.
Like you were doing her a favour.
Yeah, it was almost like that. But she was almost like, well, dude, you've had cancer. Like, yeah. Do you know what I mean? You've had heart failure. Like, you're more than good enough. And just because you can't cook this baby, it doesn't mean that you're less of a human being than someone who can cook a baby. And I think, wow, like, you've really made me feel more worthy of myself. And if someone like you can grow my child, you'd do a better job than me. But do you know what I mean? We were like, let's meet up again. And we met up again. And I brought Sati along and she brought her partner along. And they had their little boy with them as well. And we met and we had a coffee and we all got on really well. And we walked away from that meeting. Sati turned around and he said to me, she's incredible. But more incredible than her is her partner. Because this is her dream. This is something she wants to do. And he's supporting her through it. You know, and it must be so hard for the spouse. Yeah. If I want to be surrogate, because surrogacy, it's not just that she's pregnant, it affects her life, you know, it affects what she can do at home, it affects her life with her children. It must have an emotional impact on the relationship with everyone in that household. Hats off to Ina's partner and Ina, both of them, you know, without them, I wouldn't be the mum that I am today, you know, and everything about our life is just so complete because we have a baby, you know, we have Amala. And whenever I look at Amala and people, when she was little, they always used to say, you know, you wonder where the nature of your child comes from, don't you? Like, is she like a mum? Is she like a dad? And sometimes I would just be like, she might be like a surrogate mum. She's a chilled out kid. Maybe that was because the woman who carried her nurtured her in such a way that she became this, you know, incredible being. And even to this day, like, she's not just me and Sati. She's a piece of them as well. And she'll always be them.
I don't know about you, but literally when she said that she got the message from Ina in that moment where she's so poorly that she's practically saying goodbye to people, the way she spoke about it, I literally got goosebumps all over listening to it and went cold, because the universe sometimes, I don't know if
our listeners believe in all that stuff, but it just makes me think, oh my God, sometimes something helps you hold on.
Honestly, I know at the start of this, I described Karina's story as an emotional roller coaster. But when she was telling me all of the things that happened to her, and I feel like we've had to really truncate this down, the fact that she has gone in a matter of weeks, days maybe even, from nearly dying and having to record messages on her phone because she's the other side of the world, to leave for her family because she thinks that she will never get to see them or speak to them again, to nearly being a mum in the blink of an eye, I can't get over it. Didn't you say that you think her life should be a film?
Oh, it would be such an amazing film.
But do you know what? It's almost like it couldn't be a film because you
people wouldn't believe
couldn't
it.
That happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just can't believe all the twists and turns. It's just unreal.
I think it should be a film as well. So Spielberg, if you're listening, can we hook this up?
Yeah. And also, obviously, Karina, is that okay?
What was it like the time while she was pregnant? How much were you in contact? How did you feel knowing that someone else was carrying your baby?
Yeah, so it's probably important to note that while surrogacy is legal, there isn't law to protect IP or surrogate in England at the moment. So you go into it from a trust point of view and you have to talk about things that you wouldn't talk about or you may not talk about if you were going to have a baby with your partner. So we sat down at what would be our last meet before we matched and we were talking about each other's views on termination, each other's views on disabled babies, Down syndrome babies, what you would do if one parent died, what you would do if the surrogate died during childbirth, you know, all of these massive conversations. Yeah. We had to sit and talk through them and what our expectations were and how we would deal with circumstances and stuff. And we went through them and we were all on the same page and we'd sort of officially matched on a day and then we talked about dates for what we would do next. So I had these embryos that were in London at the time. We'd found a clinic in Surrey that we were going to use for our surrogacy pregnancy. So I had an appointment to Kina there and I had 11 embryos and I'd said to the consultant, you know, I want more than one child out of them. I want at least two kids out of 11 embryos and statistically that should happen. And she said, okay, fine. What I want to do is thaw all 11 embryos before you go on this cycle. Because there are only day one embryos and we needed to get to day five before we transferred into Ina. So you get the strongest of the strongest and then we'll refreeze everything at day five. We can put them back in the freezer, what's left, but you have to find the strongest one to do on your journey. So we did that. We got, you know, Ina was on a medicated cycle. So she was going through all of her meds and having scans and having a lining checked and all of that. The stuff you guess I would on a normal IVF journey. And then 5 days prior to us, our expected transfer date, we took the embryos out of the freezer and started growing them. And then we got to day five. So we had a discussion about the quality of the embryos with the embryologist, found the one that was the strongest. And Ina went into theatre and this single embryo was transferred into her. And I remember they'd said to me at the time, do you want to come into theatre? And I just thought, oh, well, that would be weird. That wouldn't be very nice for her, would it? Not thinking I'm going to see this woman give birth. But, you know, at this point, I had a problem with a little thing going into her. And I was like, no, it's fine. I'll wait. Yeah, I'm not. And to this day, it's probably one of my biggest regrets because I didn't go in. I just paced the corridors. I was like, dun, 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 when will I know? When will I know? That was on a Thursday. We had the transfer on the Friday. I called the clinic and I wanted to know how many embryos they refroze because we had quite a few that had progressed nicely. Didn't manage to get through. And then I called on Monday and didn't hear back from anyone on the Monday. And then on Tuesday, I phoned and no one answered again. And then I phoned the office and I was like, look, this is ridiculous. You were meant to refreeze my embryos on Thursday and call me immediately. No one called me. I didn't hear from you on Friday nor on Monday. What the hell's going on? And I got transferred to embryology and someone picked up the phone who I didn't know who this person was. And she just turned around and said to me, I don't know what you're talking about. We didn't save any of your material. And I was like, what? And she said, oh no, it was all discarded. And I have never been so high and then so low in such a short space of time because that news made me feel like they'd killed my children. You know, and that sounds dramatic and maybe people think, oh, come on, get a grip. But to me, I had spent years thinking I have 11 embryos, I'm going to have two babies, you know, that's my family. And then I had been in a room with a lady, an embryologist, who told me I have one really good one and then I have four that are pretty decent grade and they're going to wait for the afternoon and then freeze them. So in my head, I'm like, oh, even if there's only three left in the freezer, that's still a really good chance of having a second baby. Mm. To we've thrown it away and you have nothing. And we didn't know that Ina was pregnant at the time either, because it was only 3-4 days post-transfer. So, and I was just thought, you fuckers.
Yeah, I don't understand how that can happen.
I still don't understand how that could happen. Years on, they've never explained it. They've never apologised for it. I've looked to see where I stand legally. I don't particularly have a case. Embryos aren't worth money, apparently. I still feel really hard done by that. And it was almost like, does life just want to keep shitting on me?
Yeah.
You know, like, surely we didn't deserve it, but it happened. And we kind of just had to park it, because if I didn't, it would have consumed me. And now I didn't want anything to detract from my positive energy towards Ina, because now it was all about the one that wasn't in the bin, that was inside her. And I felt so much empathy for her, because the pressure as if that news on her was immense, you know, for that baby to stick, because she just was like, if this doesn't work, if my body doesn't do what I need it to do now, you're not going to have what you've always dreamt of. I think the next couple of days were a blur, and then Ina and I had continuous conversations that we would wait for the formal blood tests to see if the baby was going to be a baby, you know, if it was going to be. And then randomly I get loads of picture messages from Ina, right? And then one day she video calls me from her bathroom. She's like, do you want to know what I'm doing? I'm like, no, no. Do you want to know what I'm doing? No, Ina, we said 2 weeks. And she was like, I might not be able to wait 2 weeks. And maybe I haven't waited 2 weeks. And I'm like, I don't want to know. I don't want to know. Like, literally, I don't want to know. And she was like, I think I'm pregnant. I'm like, I don't want to know what you think. I'm waiting for the blood test. And then, like, we got to sort of day 7 or something, and she'd clearly been peeing on sticks left, right and centre, right? And I didn't want to get happy. Like, I just almost felt like I didn't deserve to be happy at this point, because something, you know, things seem to keep happening.
Are you joking? I'm like, you absolutely, God, you deserve more than anyone at this point to be happy after all this other stuff. Like, come on.
I know. I'm mental, isn't it? But, oh yeah, I just didn't want to believe it. And then, like, it was on a Sunday, Satty and I had gone to Wix to buy some DIY stuff, and I was standing there with a paintbrush in my hand, and she just kept sending these images. I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. I'm just going to press download, right? So press download on this thing, and these pregnancy tests come up, and there's like 2 lines. I'm like, oh my God, oh my fucking God, I'm in Wix of all places. Like, and then I looked at Satty, and he looked at me, he just gave me this look, like, do not say a word. I don't want to hear anything that you've got to say until whatever day it was of the week and we get the blood test done. I don't want to know. And I'm like, okay. Like, obviously you know, because I'm not crying. Obviously you know, but none of us are going to admit this right now. And one day she sent me another test. It was a video this time. And I was like, oh, what she sent now? And she basically had recorded a clear blue test. And I'd never seen a clear blue pregnancy test before. I didn't even know what, to be fair, obviously I'd never seen a pregnancy test. But, you know, you have a vision of what they do. But I never knew what these digital ones do. Mm. So it's just a video on this thing. It does something like it's processing. And then all of a sudden it says the word pregnant on it. And I was like, holy fuck-a-moly. We're pregnant. Like, oh my God. I literally think my heart stopped beating in that, you know, in that moment. And I just couldn't believe that it was the first attempt and it had worked. And we were now 2 weeks pregnant. And it was, oh my God, I just couldn't. And then I can still hear Satty in the back of my head. Don't tell me, don't tell me. And I thought, well, we were having our blood tests the next day. So Ina and I were meeting anyway. So we went to the clinic, did the blood tests, and they were back instantly anyway. But I went out and did a bit of shopping. I thought, I'm going to tell Satty in a really cool way. So I bought a little gift box and filled it with baby stuff. I got a card and sort of wrote how I felt about the fact we were we were having a baby, and then put some little booties in there. And I bought this, I found this grow bag, which was so apt because it just had a Winnie the Pooh on the front of it, and it said, "An adventure isn't about to begin." And I put it in this bag, and I printed off a picture of the pregnancy test that said pregnant, and then I just left the box in here. And when he came home from work, I just got him to open the box, and he was like, "No way." And I'm like, "Dude, you knew." And he was like, "I knew, but this is, now it's real, you know, now this is really happening." And oh, I don't think there will be a moment in time when I would have been happier than at that moment in time, apart from when she was born, obviously. But, you know, that from unknowing to a definitive, you are pregnant at this moment in time, is just, after everything that happened, you know, it was like, oh my God, there is a God.
So, you know, I was worried about the baby talk thing. I've just caught myself talking to my dog in my special dog voice. Good boy, Troy. Oh, what a good boy. And realised that that effectively is baby talk. So I think we're going to be fine.
Ina's like 2.5-3 hours away from us. We didn't want to miss the birth. So we booked a cottage for a week either side of due date to try and be in the area. And it was really beautiful, actually, from a surrogacy journey point of view. We had a really nice amount of time just before Amala was born for our families to just totally appreciate each other. And because we'd come to the end of the journey, I think we'd become really close, you know, and the whole thing was, I don't know, the emotion was so high. We were so charged. And then Ina had a routine midwife appointment. We all went to it. And then the midwife is like, goes silent. Oh shit, what's happened? And then she goes, "Your bump has shrunk from our last catch up and it shouldn't be happening at this point, so I need you to have a scan, ultrasound." So I do an ultrasound, and basically they're like, "The amniotic fluid, it's gone, basically." And I was like, "What does that mean?" They're like, "Baby's very dry." And I was like, "What does that mean?" They're like, "You need to go to the main hospital and you'll speak to a consultant there who will tell you what to do." So we went to the hospital and they said, "Look, we need to get you induced now because it's dangerous for the baby. She's got no fluid." And I was like, "Okay, fine, let's do it." And she was like, "Oh, we don't have any delivery rooms available, so we're gonna have to delay it." And I was like, no. Like, honestly, like, I said to the doctor, like, "What's the worst case scenario in this?" And they're like, "Well, stillbirth's the ultimate risk." And I was like, "Dude, that is not a risk I'm willing to take." Like, you know, so we went away, and then Ina was really, she was so worried because she was like, "I haven't been counting the kicks because I've been really content with the pregnancy. So now I don't know what's normal or what's normal." She called the hospital. They just called her in, kept her under observation, induced her. And then she went into labor and we sort of waited to be called. Sati and I were outside and we were like, "Ah, what's going on?
That must have felt like the longest wait of your life.
Honestly, it was, because the plan was that I would be with Ina throughout the process, but, you know, she was in so much pain that she didn't want us in the room. She just needed her partner there. So we waited outside, and then a nurse came out and they're like, "Oh, we've just given her an epidural, so she'll be okay. We'll you can go in soon." She said, "As soon as she's calmed down, you're welcome to go in." So, you know, eventually we went in the room and things were great. And then the boys went to have a coffee together because things were a bit slow moving, and Ian and I were just chatting, and then she started contracting. But what happened is her epidural line had come out somehow. So she was just off the scale in pain. And I was like, "I can't do anything right now to help you." And she was on the gas in air because obviously the epidural wasn't doing what she thought, what she wanted it to do. I mean, I've never felt so useless and almost worthless, because they were tracking Amala's heart rate because there'd been complications and it was all over the place, and almost like I could see her heart rate. And I'm thinking back to Vancouver, you know, and my heart when it was like that, and I was like, I need my baby to be safe, but equally I need this woman to be healthy and safe as well. I can't risk her life because I want this life. And I just thought, well, you know, I couldn't do it for myself, and now I've, look what I've done to her. And in the end, we had to go into theatre because Amala was just not particularly happy and Ina was in so much pain. So we went into theatre and they said to us, "Look, we're potentially going to C-section here." And then by this time, sort of everyone's in tears, but Ivars and I quickly get our scrubs on. We head down to theatre with Ina. And again, I'm sitting there thinking, this is really weird, you know, a mother at the birth of her baby, but I'm just sitting here, you know, and my partner's nowhere to be seen. And it was just just so bizarre. And then there's a shift change. It was 8 o'clock in the evening, shift change. And a midwife comes in, and one of them we'd been really good friends with because we'd been in for a few days, and she saw Sati in recovery. And then before you know it, he's got these scrubs on and he just appears next to me. And I was like, oh my God, she got you in. And the woman and the midwife, she was like, there's no way he was going to miss his baby's birth when he was here. And I was like, oh my God. And it was the most perfect moment. Ina might say otherwise, but, you know, there was Ina, and then she had Ivars with him. I was next to her partner, and then Sati was next to me, and it was the four of us, you know, and it was all about the four of us. This, it was never a journey about just an infertile couple. It was a journey about four incredible people. And then literally within minutes, they got Amala out with forceps. So she was born, we were all there, and they held her up, and, oh, that moment is just magic. Magic on so many levels. For me, it was that she was born 5 years after she was created as an embryo, and her parents had been through so much, and this woman who was once a stranger nurtured her, grew her, gave her life, and then she was in my arms as if that was where she belonged. It was just the most beautiful thing in the world.
Where do you actually find these people? I want to be her best friend now. I feel like I'm very fickle, and every week I want to be everyone's new best friend.
Do you know what? I said this to someone the other day. I was like, I feel like I am such a brown noser of all the people who come on the podcast, but genuinely, I'm so in awe of them opening up the intimate details of their lives to us. But yeah, where did I find her? Good old Instagram. But yeah, what a woman. And the fact that there are points in her story where she questions whether or not she deserves to be happy. And I felt like, even in the interview, I felt like I needed to shake her and be like,
are you serious?
Oh my God, yes, you deserve to be happy.
Yes, so happy. And I love her humor and everything. I think she's really funny.
She's flipping hilarious. She and she talks, like the way she talks about her life, where she'll talk about something really serious and then just has that super infectious laugh.
Definitely. I don't know how she wasn't fuming, though, at the binning the embryos.
Well, I think she was. And
I'm not saying she wasn't fuming.
No,
obviously,
of course.
You would be. But when she talks about it, like, I was so angry.
And I agree. And I think anyone listening to that will also wholeheartedly have felt a level of rage. But do you want some good news?
Yeah.
So I recorded this interview with Karina just before lockdown. So it meant I could sit in a room with her and I could give her a hug afterwards, because we both had a bit of a cry while we were doing it, which was lovely. Mm. And obviously she talked about one of the key things for her was that when the embryos were thrown away, she felt like that was her family that she saw in her future gone.
Yeah.
It's not, because she's having another baby via a surrogate, a different surrogate. So I think that they have used an egg donor. But not only is there one baby in there, there are two babies, and they are due almost exactly the same time as me.
Oh my God, I'm actually nearly crying. I'm not even kidding. That's so lovely.
I didn't tell you before because I knew that you would love it.
Why are you doing this to me? I'm on my period. Oh my God, that's so nice. And I'm so happy.
So the other day, Karina posted on Instagram with like an adventure is about to begin and a scam picture. And I was like, what the heck? And then the next one, there will be double the fun, twins. So yeah, she's having two babies and is absolutely buzzing. So yes,
I don't know how you expect me to speak now. even more of the film. Oh my God. Oh, that's so lovely. I'm so happy.
Spielberg's definitely in now, isn't he?
Absolutely. Oh my God, that's so nice. I'm so happy.
Follow my journey and tell us about your own on social media. We are at To Baby or Not. If you rate and review this podcast, please do. Not only will it hugely help us out, but it'll guarantee that you too will find a bargain bin posh pushchair and you can be super smug for days.
next time on To Baby or Not To Baby.
I cannot cope with feeling this out of control. I don't know what's happening with the bleeding. No one seems to know what's going on. People are rushing in and out the room, and it just felt scary.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.